If you don't like capitalism and you don't like state socialism, what do you want?
And there is a great deal of new construction of new institutions, new forms, new cooperatives, new worker-owned companies that's happening all over the country.
This is the Gar Alperovitz Podcast, a regular look at the ideas of historian and political economist Gar Alperovitz as he explores strategies to democratize wealth and empower workers and communities.
All of the three panelists have been extremely gracious in abiding by very strict time limits so that we can have a really rich discussion. So I ask that the questioners also exhibit similar restraint. And let's go ahead. We'll start from this end.
On the question of economic democracy, there are some quandaries that occur to me. Let's say that on the worker, you have workers who are benefiting from being in a polluting industry that for social reasons needs to be shut down. Yet their livelihood depends on it. If they are given democratic rights about the decision-making in their industry, they're not going to close to the detriment of the community. And on the consumer end, if people don't want to give up their cars and their consumption of gasoline, even though national and global imperatives dictate that we build high-speed rail as an alternative to cars and planes and so forth, they will not vote to do that. I mean, this goes back to Socrates, who posed the issue of the majority is not always the wisest, white Beloit. Does not always embody the greatest wisdom. So when you have urgent imperatives like this, economic, social imperatives that might clash with the will of the majority, doesn't that dictate some degree of exercise of authority to attain larger social goals?
Okay, so this question is not for Rick, because I kind of know how Rick's going to answer this question, but I'm curious to hear from the other two panelists how they would look at women's household labor in the household, when household labor is about a third to a quarter of the economy, it's sizable. Mm. And if you're talking about community or even the environment, recycling, self-provisioning, all this stuff goes on in the home. So I'd like to see how that fits into your...
Yeah, some communities are distributed all over, so for that, the community should be considered the whole country, and I feel the whole world. And then how do you decide who is going to control?
Yeah, I can say something on all those. I mean, first of all, yeah, pollution, yeah, you have to do under any system. You're going to have laws saying you're not allowed to do that, okay? Or there's going to be an extra charge put on so we can clean it up. I mean, so I think, that's a role for government, okay, to set those standards. Would people cut back on the use of cars? Now, here, I do want to argue, and I think we all agree, just having a certain kind of economic does not guarantee, you're going to get all the good things you want. You need other movements pushing for these things as well, right? So, yeah, the majority want to be racist, and the majority want to pollute, and is Democrat, well, yeah, you're going to get that. So it's important. So democracy isn't the whole answer, but it's the crucial part there. And here again, with the productivity, one thing about the model I'm talking about, you've got democratic control over investment, okay? You realize that if you're going to cut back certain things, certain industries are going to have to be scaled back. You're going to need funds to set up ways for them to do other things, okay? Or figure out ways of how to make this transition to more leisure, rather than just more consumption. So you've got the tools here. You've got control over funds to do these kinds of things, okay? But it's going to take a movement. It's going to take a sense of what do we want to save the planet or not save the planet, in order, to do these things. Democracy isn't an automatic answer. Should I say something about the other two?
Sure.
Please. Okay. About women's household labor, I mean, this is about, the productive part of the economy, in the money part of the economy, okay? Of course, women are massively involved in that, too. In fact, everyone now is feeling the labor squeeze. So this is one of the reasons why I think giving workers the opportunity to scale back their hours of work, and men as well as women can be involved in the crucially important care labor that has to be done. Plus, a socialist society would have public provisions of daycare and quality education and those sorts of things. But once again, no, you need an independent women's movement also pushing. Hey, look, guys, let's You believe in democracy, you believe in equality. Let's make sure our workplace is that way too, and let's make sure that, you know, there's enough time, you know, for everybody to do these other crucially important things. The commuting the whole world, again, the modeling is more elaborate form, says you collect this surplus centrally. Okay, it's a flat rate capital tax of all the capital. Okay, when it comes to the center, you do have to have your legislature, you know, making a decision. Certain amount of that we're going to set aside for these global, the projects that are national in scope. What's left goes back to the states, the state legislatures, which are the projects that are statewide in scope. Then it goes to the communities. And this is why, I mean, I think Gar's right, the importance of community. You've got community banks that each and every year get funds coming in, and it's up to the community to decide how to allocate these funds and so on. So it tries to deal with those problems also.
Yeah, I think there has to be a willingness for those that are interested in moving in the direction of a radical reorganization of how we do production, to remember that with that will go all sorts of other adjustments. Just like the transition into capitalism rewrote the relationships among producing units that had existed in feudalism, so the transition to a different way of organizing enterprises will carry with it, as a necessary part of the historical process and as a way for these newly organized collective enterprises to survive, the necessary adjustments in the rest of society. For example, the presumption in the first part of your comment, the first commentator, was that your job depends on the enterprise in which you work. Well, but why should it? That makes no sense at all. And in this society, that would become crystal clear. If the needs for a particular kind of production, for whatever reason, change, then we need fewer workers in that business to do that. And in a reasonable society premised on the guarantee of a job, as Gar said, then there would be no question that anybody who works in that enterprise will have a job whether or not that enterprise produces more or less. If it produces less, we now have an interesting problem. Some portion of the workers producing something are no longer needed there. Well, I can imagine interesting arrangements. A survey could be taken among the workers. Which of you is the most interested in trying something else? In going to school to learn something else? In moving to another part of the country? We would have a democratic way of selecting within the group those who would be least inconvenienced by or most interested in moving somewhere else, with, of course, the maintenance of your same salary and the educational costs of your adjustment mastered. And the reason we would do that is because anything else would be irrational. Anything else would... We don't want to lose that person's productivity, and we certainly don't want them to produce stuff we don't need. That's obvious. So we got to move them to someplace else, and having them unemployed for a period of time is completely crazy, since they want to work and we need the output, or the leisure. That's a choice, of course. And we would arrange it that way. The only reason capitalism didn't do that is capitalism has a problem. If the government guarantees, in effect, to take care of everybody all the time, then you haven't got that stick in the relationship between the capitalist and the worker. Mm-hmm. You can't fire anybody ever. That's not going to be allowed in capitalism, because the flexibility of rising and falling wages with the cycle would thereby be interrupted. So capitalism couldn't go in that direction. It was blocked by its own logic from something which socialists have from day one understood is fundamentally irrational. In the United States today, we have something on the order of 20 or 25 million people in an unemployed status. We have one-third of our productive capacity sitting idle, gathering rust and dust, and we complain that we can't rebuild our cities, provide daycare for our children, and elder care for our aging population. That's crazy. The people want to work. The material for them to work with and on is available. The output that we would get from it is socially useful. And this is a system. We can't put that together. That's a problem for capitalism. But we wouldn't have that kind of problem in another kind of system. Second thing, rather than respond, I won't deal with what Cecilia asked me not to deal with, so I won't do that. On the question of control, rather than answer, let me problematize the question. In the transition from feudalism to capitalism, when we change the organization of production from lord and serf to employer-employee or capitalist and proletariat, we did that, or the world did that, and we organized the enterprises, who then discovered, that they had to work out all kinds of what? Complicated relationships between the enterprises and one another, between the enterprises and the consuming public, and between the enterprises and the surrounding communities. We're not the first ones to worry about that. But that has to be worked out in any system. And a communist system, or if that's troubling for you, a collective or cooperative system, or if that's troubling for you, a workers all together loving each other system, or whatever word makes it palatable for you to swallow this thing, they will have to work out mutually acceptable relationships among each other, with the public, and with the communities. Last point. If we really want the community to have a say, which I think is where GAR is going, in the decisions made within an enterprise, which I think is eminently reasonable, then the argument has to go the other way too. Then the community's decisions require input of the workers as well. And the model there would be in Weimar Germany. In many ways, one of the most democratic moments that capitalism has ever seen. The short period of time, the 1920s, after the socialists took over for the first time in Germany, after World War I. They're interesting because they had a parliament composed of two houses. One house, people were elected according to where they lived. And the other house were elected by people according to where they worked. And they had to work out a government which took into consideration the community, defined geographically, and the labor force, defined by its work. And therefore, we even have models with which to begin to formulate democratic mutual arrangements. And that will happen if this transition in a revolutionary moment can be achieved.
So let me pick up on that, because this last step particularly, that articulation, the structuring of work, there are many different ways to do it. The Weimar was one way to do it. But that it doesn't just happen by chance, that worker-owned companies are here and the community's there. For us now, at this stage of the evolutionary revolution, we need to think through some of these things, and as we're trying to do in this meeting today, to begin to say, how can we do this in an intelligible way? What problems do we know? What can we anticipate from other historical experience? And Rick is right. The complex relationship between community and workers is different from traditional worker ownership alone floating in the capitalist or socialist market. So that's a problem. We'll open it up as a problem for all of us. I mean, I write about it. We all write about that in one way or another. I would add this point, and this, I think, is in some socialist writing and a lot of other traditional writing is very, very weak. Institutions have interests, and they build power out of institutional bases. So we know this when we look at the corporation and the bankers. They want to control the politics. Worker owners do too. It is not automatic that the institutional design will produce a result. The environmental question becomes obvious. Worker ownership of General Motors would produce as much pollution today as capitalist ownership, because they're in a competitive market. So the design of institutions, and you can't just pass laws, say, hey, don't do that, because as we know, who makes the laws is a function also of the institutional power relationships. So you have to dig deeper to that set of questions. We don't have time to do that in detail today, but I just want to open that out. And this last exchange, I think, helped clarify another one. I want to speak a little bit from a different angle on the question of unpaid labor or paid labor. I'm for paid labor. Paid household work is an option. I'm for that. But let me give you a planning problem that comes up in one chapter of my book on this. The design of communities today in capitalism is designed to destroy the possibility of joint male-female raising of the children and parenting, because they're spread out. And the one has to commute in. Who's going to stay home? Usually the woman. Or you hire somebody else, who means that woman can't take care of her kids. So the structure of a system that prioritized a different relationship would bring together in geographic proximity home, work, and household and labor, and open time for moving back and forth between the two, and space. The spatial design of cities is sexist. It is designed to break down the possibility of joint raising, and there is no support either in it. But that would be my kind of shorthand
I've spelled out longer in my book, but that's a shorthand way to get beyond the sexist design city.
We'll do three more questions, starting with you, and then you in the back.
I'd like the speakers to address the question of what unions would look like under these socialist arrangements, and maybe broaden a little bit to dissident worker movements. I'm thinking in particular situations like during World War II, when white industrial workers organized to recruit after some jobs. So things of that. How would things like that look?
You mentioned that institutional power affects, you know, the making of laws. And you also talk about democracy quite a bit. And I'm wondering if you have at all re-envisioned the community decision-making model as not just being based off elections and voting for representatives, but looking at other models as well.
What unintended consequences have you seen from the Cleveland model?
Okay, I take a couple of them. The role of unions, that is an important question. And again, theoretically, if you've got a democratic workplace, why do you need unions? Okay, I mean, unions are supposed to protect the interests of the workers against, you know, the interest of management, but, you know, workers are their managers. Now, in a place like Mondragon, for example, they do sort of have a union element in that they have two different councils. They got the worker council that appoints the management and looks at these. And then they've got a social council that's elected, you know, that looks at employment, you know, remuneration, inequalities, and so on and so forth. Those kinds of things that unions are traditionally concerned themselves with, you know. So that is an issue that's going to have to be worked out because, I mean, it is interesting that the U.S. Steelworkers recently signed an agreement with Mondragon to work together to figure out how to set up, you know, Mondragon-style cooperatives that do have a place for unions, you know, in them and so on. So we're going to have to see how that one plays out. Democratic decision-making, I haven't given much thought of that, but I do have a little bit in my book about at least democracy at the large scale, and that is you've got to have a radical revisioning of democracy itself, okay? Campaign financing for one thing, you know, obviously you got to get money out of, you know, the electors. But there's another element of democracy that very few people pay attention to. And it's built into the capitalist democracy. What other occupation can a person go into and work their way through where every 2 years you got to stand for election and possibly lose your job? Okay. Is it any wonder that when you're in that position, you got to make deals with lobbyists and so on and so forth. You got to redistrict. You got to do all these kinds of things, okay? To protect yourself, you got a family, you got a mortgage, you know, you can't just every 2 years possibly lose everything. Mm-hmm. So figuring out a way of envisioning democracy, you've got a place to go when you lose elections, you know, back to your previous place of employment or something like that. But that's as far as I've gotten in thinking that through.
Let me try to respond to the thing with unions. The two levels in my mind. First is the question of the role of unions in the struggle we hopefully will be entering on now to move this country in the direction of these kinds of restructured enterprises. What would be the relationship of unions to that? Which is a different question from imagining what unions would look like once we got there. I don't really have much to say on the second question because it gets me into the position of imagining the future, and beyond some general comments, I'm not sure that's terribly productive, at least for me. But I have a lot of thoughts about the unions now, and it starts from that steelworkers deal with the Mondragon. Well, it's not really a deal. It was a statement of intention. It's not clear, at least for me, what more beyond the statement of intention has in fact happened.
The current steelworkers.
Yeah, the current steelworkers thing. They announced an alliance that they were going to work together and so forth, but it was short and it was general. But I thought it was profound in its implications. It opened a space, and that's where I'm going to go say the following. Imagine a union strategic shift. Instead of unions doing what they have traditionally done, which is to bargain collectively on behalf of the workers they represent with an employer to determine a contract over work conditions for a period of time. In short, using the old Marxian language, they were bargaining over the terms of the deal by which workers sell their capacity to work to an employer. And they wanted the best deal possible, like anybody representing anyone in an exchange. And they wanted better conditions, better prices. The unions did that. And workers were to be better off by bargaining collectively than they could have been by bargaining individually. Suppose a second track. Unions were to reconceptualize their role and add a second track to that first one, to have a dual strategy. Here's the second strategy. Unions will systematically initiate, organize, finance, and develop worker-operated, worker-directed enterprises. They'll do it when a capitalist employer collapses, Argentina kind of example. They will do it when a capitalist employer demands conditions for the workers in the first track that are not acceptable. There's now a second strategy. Not a strategy of work stoppage and not a strategy of strike. A whole new weapon. We're going to go into business competing with you. And we're going to use your workers to do it. So beware of not giving us what we want on track two, one, because we got track two. My guess is that that's where the United Steelworkers' thinking was going, although it was hard to tell from the statement. But I'd like to think it was, and whether it was or not, that would be a way for unions both to move the country in a new direction, to offer us all the chance to see in concrete ways how such enterprises were functioning, to perhaps begin a global, a national campaign to say that the best way to solve the unemployment problem would be to have a public employment program in which not only did unemployed people get a job, but a new kind of enterprise was set up, run and directed by the workers, so everybody in America would finally have a freedom of choice to choose between an old line hierarchical capitalist enterprise and a new non-capitalist. Whoa. Here's unions with a new strategy that is both social in its implications, getting them back to being a social movement and not a narrowly worker-focused movement, as well as strengthening them with the employer. I think that might be an interesting way to put these ideas together with union thinking, union strategizing. On the question of democratic control, I think we have a problem. I think representative democracy has been so polluted by what has happened over the last 100 years of capitalism, in which the representatives have been bought out so easily, so frequently, and so utterly, that we have to go through a period of time, which maybe will last, I don't know, forever, in which we abandon, I mean this seriously, we abandon representative democracy. Either by having what used to be called direct democracy, in which we create the time and the financial support for everybody to really participate and learn in a decision-making process. If we want to have workers be directors, we're changing the definition of work and a job. It means you learn to do not just your particular task in a division of labor, but everyone learns all that he or she needs to know to be a director and designer of the workplace. That means we all have to learn participatory democracy, because that's what it entails. If we decide even for a short time to hold on as a transition to representative democracy, then our old socialist idea ought to be revived. It's called the system of rotation. Everybody who is a representative of everybody else can't do it for more than a short time where he or she has to give way to everybody else playing that role, so that nobody does as a director what he or she would be uncomfortable having done to them when they are finished with directing. And that rotational idea, which is old in socialism, could be brought back as a necessary accompaniment to whatever representative democracy is held on to.
So here, I agree with this last line of developing thought. But I want to add something in two different dimensions on this particular question on democracy and on the unions. I mentioned this Youngstown fight that we had in 1977. What is interesting for historical change and development, so if you think you lose fights and win fights, watch the sequence here. In Youngstown, the local radical steelworkers were the ones who wanted to set up the company. The international, the union headquarters, didn't want these radicals in their union because they were troublemakers for the leadership. The international undercut the local and destroyed the worker ownership company. What is interesting, though, is over 30 years, the steelworkers are now for worker ownership. There has been a progression and development, particularly in the state of Ohio, out of these fights that give you a sense of possibility over time. So that leadership, and the idea, the second idea of setting up your own company, that's right there. That was the Youngstown. And we're beginning to see it in SEIU, the beginnings of these kinds of, these are not abstract ideas. You could actually find a way to do something about this in some locality if you look. These people are doing it in Ohio, in Cleveland, which is a devastated city. They can do it there. You can do it almost any place if you actually bend to it. On the question of democracy, there are a couple problems I want to add to this discussion of whether we have sortition or there are, you know, people rotating. Like, there have been many systems of direct democracy, including, you know, what happens when you go to a lawsuit. People become the jury by selection randomly. That was the old, that was the Socrates system. So there are many ways that political science is looking at improving direct democracy, including the ones that Rick was talking about, which I support. The real question from my point of view is, how do we build an environment which begins to genuinely encourage the reconstruction of democratic practice? And I don't think that can be done absent local experience. So that the community needs to begin to, this is Tocqueville, it's the Paris Commune, it's many theorists, and unless you have democracy in your own experience, you don't know how to do it. That means actually engaging structures locally and rebuilding. Now, that also means you must have sufficient economic stability or the community dissolves from under you. Cleveland's gone from 800,000 to 400,000. You can't have decision-making that's democratic when you destroy the community. But the literal reconstruction of democratic process in community is a critical element of the next stage of development. Final piece on this. Again, we're opening up lots of good dimensions here. America is now 315 million people. It is continental in scale. You can drop Germany in Montana. Those are dinky little countries compared with the scope and scale of this system. It is not obvious that you can have democracy in a system that is 3,000 miles, 300 million people, and moving towards 500 million unless you actually start talking about regional reconstruction, breaking down the system. So I think that's part and parcel dealing with the scale problem and the community problem as well, if you're going to get to the direct democracy question.
Great. We'll do three more around this area, and then we'll cycle back.
Yeah, my question relates to the market. Are you in favor of allowing the market to set value, the price of something? I'm particularly interested in all your answers, but Richard was talking about the socialism under the command economy didn't solve the production issue, but I always thought if you read a bit more of Marx, you would find that his view of communism was no money. And I think you'll find that reinforced by the people in the Russian Revolution. They thought money would disappear. That you can't really do that without abolishing the market. That's the other, related question is setting, you know, commensurability. Which was an issue that did come up in the German Revolution, and they were tinkering with the idea of not having that strict nexus. Now, I can't quite understand how David's system will work. It sounds like you're wanting to have your cake and eat it as well. I mean, you sound like, I was reading Poverty and Philosophy, and Marx was attacking people who thought they could think with money and markets and still have socialism. He called them utopian socialism. That's what you sound like. Tell me he's wrong.
Okay.
Considering a couple of factors, which are, one, I don't think it's been addressed, the exhaustion of fossil fuels in the next few decades, which is made even more urgent by the need to do something about global warming. Everything I've seen, say the International Forum on Globalization, this, there has to be a massive cutback in consumption, which is a profound social change in America. There has to be, according to many people I read, a massive population control, which is a topic that's even taboo on the left, and there has to be a transformation from a globalized economy to a local, touched on things you said, a local, locally autonomous economies. And just on that last point, globalization, one of the things that every economist I've read, from the most, traditional Marxist acknowledges that it's impossible to have a computer in every pot, in every garage. It's not feasible to, for everyone in the world to have a computer. So that's another dream that has to be relinquished. So I'm wondering how they respond to these kind of cultural and economic changes that I seem to me to be imperative.
Yesterday, there was a workshop on the concept of community, and after presentations about the history of the word and the concept in the English language, reading through it and talking about how it's been used by both all the left, right, and center in North America, the brief punchline is simply that it is often and almost always treated as an self-evident good. It's very rarely examined or given any concrete meaning other than to sort of romanticize it. I'm wondering whether in your work in Cleveland, this idea of having the community be a very crucial concept in this relationship, you've come to any greater refinement of the concept.
Okay, allowing markets to work, this Proudhon, remember, I'm saying there's three markets. Okay, there's this market for goods and services, there's the labor market and the capital market. It's the labor market we're changing, it's the capital market we're changing. So you're not allowing the market, for example, to set your long-term priorities and so on. As James Galbraith recently remarked, the problem with markets is poor don't count and the future doesn't count. Okay, so we're not going to have poor in a democratic society. You're going to guarantee, everyone has a right to work, okay? You're going to have social needs taken care of, and you're not just letting the market determine your long-term future. That's where you're collecting this investment fund. You can plan the allocation of that investment fund.
Are you abolishing profit?
Not abolishing profit. And profit just accruing to capital is abolished, okay? But workers, see, profit is different under a democratic economy. Profit is the difference between, in both cases, costs and sales, right? But costs of production under capitalism include labor costs. That's not the way profit works here. Profit is the difference between what you pay for your raw materials and building and what you sell for. That gets divided up among workers. But also, a piece of that gets taxed away for the investment fund, for the general long-term investment in the community. So, there's no good system, I think, that's just going to replace the competitive market. Enterprises compete, they got to be efficient that way, you got to pay attention to what consumers want, and that sort of thing, which I think is good. The no money question, my argument is, in another book, that you'd see the money wither away, not in the sense that it would disappear altogether, you need some kind of accounting, but it becomes not important anymore. You've got good work, you've got a stable economy, it doesn't drive anything anymore. Okay, the exhaustion of fossil fuels, global warming, granted that's going to take a massive reordering. And you can't do, now, there's no guarantee you would get that under a democratic economy either, because people are going to have to make choices. But you would at least have control over your investment. You can make decisions about investment, and you can do it in such a way that the people that are going to get affected are compensated. You do find other work, you do reduce work hours, something like that. You can got the tools in a democratic economy. Population control is not talked about, but I think because we actually know the problem there. Advanced countries don't have population problems. Poverty and education of women, and Marcus Sen pointed this out a long time ago. When people have enough money, and if women are educated and have genuine options, you don't have this problem of massive, you know, population increase. Local economy, yeah, I think, you know, and community, sort of putting those together, one of the advantages of the democratic model is, first of all, communities are much more stable, and workers don't vote to move to another part of the country or another part of the world, okay? So they don't behave just like capitalist firms. And each and every year, there are funds coming into your community. You've got to make decisions about things. So, you know, communities now is often local government giving out the bad news to people. You know, what we got to cut next. I mean, here you'd actually have a situation where funds are coming in. We've got to decide, you know, what's the best way to handle those kinds of things. So I think it makes, I think communities are important. I mean, I absolutely agree with that. And the democratic experience in communities, and I think it's much more viable when you have something like economic democracy.
About the markets, I think they're a wonderful example of something that we're going to encounter all the time as we try to make change, which has always been true for people who want to make social change. Hard to develop the new ways of thinking. Because the market was stressed as the quintessential component of capitalism, which, as I argued at the beginning, I think was a misreading, if you like, of Marx, we have the extreme other way. Socialism came to define itself as the negation, the total notness of the other. You know, ever since Hegel, we should have learned, right, that the opposites are united, and that we never have the either-or quite so neatly arranged as these polar oppositions would have us believe. And indeed, in practice, I'm not aware of any society in which planning was dominant, which didn't make use of markets, and I know of no society in which markets were dominant, where there isn't lots of planning going on, that neither theoretically nor empirically is there much warrant for this, number one. Number two, I think it would help if we kept markets separate from the question of the organization of production. Marx happened to be a critic of the capitalist organization of production and also a critic of markets. But they are different objects and they have different critiques. There's nothing unique about markets in terms of capitalism. Non-capitalist systems have made use of markets throughout human history. Societies in which communal organizations of production existed a long time ago used markets. Slave societies used markets, feudal societies, so on. So Marx is part of a tradition that comes out of the Renaissance and so on that had the idea that an organic, holistic community of people who knew and took care of each other was disrupted by the intrusion into it of markets, that markets wrecked the interpersonal mutual support of ancient communities. In that, he replicates huge numbers of scholars. Marx liked to tell people, read Balzac. And the reason he wanted people to read Balzac is Balzac made entire beautiful novels out of the disruption of people's lives by having a market relationship intrude where there once was feeling, affect, love, and care. And if you go back to Plato and Aristotle, they debated markets. Plato was dead set against markets on the grounds that they disrupted the life of the Greek city-states. Aristotle's answer to Plato was, you're right, but it would be so socially disruptive to undo the market system we're in that we have to limit ourselves to rigidly controlling markets, and that's the resolution of this situation. Notice, we live in a society where, I can tell from your faces, the awareness that Plato and Aristotle hated markets was not part of your consciousness. Well, that's not your fault. That's because the culture we live in has to live in these polar opposites. So I think my answer is, Marx is interesting but not original in his critique of markets. Marx is interesting and original in his critique of the organization of production. You can buy one or the other or both, but I would be more supple. I would urge you to be more supple, and I guess I'm with David on this, to understand that markets can play roles depending on how they're constricted and constrained. And we have to remember that not to get caught in the dialectic extreme opposition. Secondly, on fossil fuels, I think the proposals we're pushing toward would make a radical difference. I would disagree a little bit with David. It's not just a question of making choices. Think of it this way. We've been unable to have the following choice in our culture about the automobile. It's never been possible to go to the mass of the people and say, here's a choice. You can have the private automobile, and it'll cost you this many dead people on the highway, this many, seriously, this much injury, this much pollution, since it's the major polluter of the air, and so forth. Or we can move to a system of collective transportation, mass transportation. That will cost you. You won't have the convenience of a car quite the way you do. You'll have to go to the edge of the city where the city will maintain fleets of cars, borrowing from, I don't know, Hertz, and doing it as a public service. And here's the benefit. You will save millions of people's lives. You will save millions of people's jobs. There'll be lots of leisure for everybody because we've gone to something much, much cheaper. We can now conceptualize that, but it's an act of the thought because the real world doesn't make that possible. In a socially organized worker where nobody's job depends on the car being produced, that would become a real choice that could be actually made in a way that we can't do now, and that's a reason for moving in that direction.
Oh, lots of questions. On the question of, let me link a couple of these together. First, let me say something. Enough with us guys up here. We are, the importance of this particular meeting and the dialogue that the three of us are having with you, and I'm talking about it, the person in your seat, this is the time we need to come up with really coherent answers to these questions, all of us collectively. Get in the game. Don't wait for somebody to give you an answer. This stuff is very important now. And you, we're writing about it, lots of people are writing about it, but I want to encourage you yourselves to get into, we're talking about economic theory, we're talking about democratic theory, we're talking about ecological theory, we're talking about global issues that haven't come up enough in this group. There are a whole series of fundamental questions. They come down to, in simple terms, what the hell do you want? And if you don't know, why should we listen to you? And what is the design of the new system? Is it worker ownership? Is it community? Is it planning? These are hot questions for the first time in American history since the beginning of the 20th century, when there was Deb's beginning discussion of it, municipal socialism, all that sort of thing. This is ripe. And what the second contention is, you can also, if you drop the rhetoric and know what the hell you're talking about in answer to these questions, you can talk to Americans about this, because they know something's wrong. So if you clarify your own thinking about these problems and turn it into American language rather than rhetoric, you will find people can hear you. They know there's a big problem. So I want to urge that as not our problem, but our problem. So get into the act. Okay. Get to work. Let me say one other thing, just in response to the question about community. In a democratic community, there must be all of the people involved. That's called a community. You can jazz it up with rhetorical poetry and so forth, and you do need to have culture of community, and there are many themes. But simply in terms of decision-making in a democracy, it's everybody in the room. So that's the fundamental principle. Now take a city like Youngstown or take a city like Cleveland or many of the others. And this goes to partly what was just talked about in terms of mass transit. You pull the plug on that city by taking the jobs out of the corporations. They come in for a tax benefit. They get the benefit. They leave. 800,000 in Cleveland, now 400,000. Detroit is worse. You can't have a group of people who live there long enough to actually be engaged in democratic process, who have a stake in the operation. They don't give a damn where the people went. Where did they go? We don't know. But to have a democracy, you also have to have stability. So it becomes a requirement of the design that we are going to create collectively that we can provide when we move from the auto industry to a mass transit industry, that those jobs help stabilize those communities. This is different from the little communities all having nice gardens vision. This also includes advanced production and high tech, and how do we actually organize our planning system to make that part of it happen with the use of markets to keep the planning system in line, because that can get out of line too. These are the problems that we're all actually up against now. So come on and join the game. It's not our game at all at this table.
Okay, so for those who need to go on to the next panel, feel free to do so. We've run over time. We'll do one more round.
In Cleveland, where you're running these enterprises, have you run across the problem of any resistance from existing companies that do these same things? And that's really a question about the transition from one system to another. How do you deal with that kind of resistance? More efficient, lower profit.
Do we just want to go? Yeah, you want to do?
Yeah, we'll just do a rapid fire, I guess.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. The question was, in Cleveland, what about the competitors? Aren't they going to be angry? I'll give you a secret. Worker-owned companies are more productive on average than non-worker-owned companies, not surprisingly, particularly if you do adequate training. So none of these are subsidized. They have to beat the market. So we're not confident, but we're pretty confident they'll be able to do it because they actually perform better when you have people have a stake in the operation. We haven't run into it yet.
I think who was two? You were two?
I'd just like to make a comment that my disappointment in the fact that what I was expecting to hear was alternatives to capitalism. What I've heard is variations in capitalism, just like socialism and communism. And the reason I say that is I think it'd be worthwhile to change the name capitalism to moneyism. And all the systems that you people are recommending use money. And if you want to get rid of capitalism, you have to get rid of money. Now, the question is, can you imagine an economy where money is not the means of control?
Did you want to say anything else? I'll just say no, I don't think it's a variety of capitalism. You know, money obviously was present in ancient slave societies and it was present under feudalism and so on and so forth. That's not a defining feature. I do think we can imagine the withering away of the market and money, not in the sense that you need anything at all. You got to keep track of who's producing what, how much, and so on and so forth. But the role that it plays, you know, in life will change over time.
I wanted to ask, I think we've been very focused on like a national level, and how do you guys imagine a global governance system, and what is the mechanism for redistribution of wealth between countries, and how do power relations between countries work? Could you comment on that?
My question was similar to that, but I'd expand on it.
Yeah.
To do like come together, let's just assume that today a revolution happened and then some conception of this new economy goes forward. How do we interface with international economies which haven't made the switch? And two, would there be bananas in the future, or is simply the mechanism of bringing the banana here too malicious to both the environment and like the collective good to even have bananas here, essentially, or banana just as an abstract?
Okay, my question has to do with what we were saying just a few minutes ago about having discussions about this. You have an email, e-letter out that, you know, that I've been answering with the democracy in the workplace, and I'm wondering if perhaps there could be meetings in the city at maybe the BREC or something where people actually do come together like this, maybe once a week or a month or whatever, and we all have a discussion. And everybody theorizes.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Mr. Horowitz about Cleveland. I'm very interested in it, and I want to make it available to others. Yeah. And I'm wondering, beyond the book, are there websites or individuals that you might recommend?
Okay. Well, that's an easy one. Just go to community-wealth.org, and you'll find all sorts of references to that.
Okay, great.
Community-wealth. Put the dash in, because there's one without.
There's another one, which we're just about to launch, called democracyatwork.info. All one word, democracyatwork.info.
At is A-T.
Yes, democracy, the word. democracyatwork.info.
And the first one was
community-wealth.org.
Can
I respond to some of these?
Yeah, please. Okay, go ahead.
On the question of money, I don't want to repeat what has already been said. Just to remember, and allow me to put my
hat on as economist. Money is a unit of account, a measure of value, and a store of value. Many of the problems that we associate with money have to do with the use that is made of it. One or another of those things becoming more important than the others, which is a function of the environment, not inherent in the money. If money simply keeps track of the relationships among us, it's no different than keeping numbers in a book. If it becomes a way to control the way the gentleman's question was, then it's a problem. But that has to do with the structural and institutional environment within which money plays its role, and that can be limited or controlled in the ways that was said. And so I would agree, it's not the presence or its absence that defines capitalism. There have been times when capitalist relationships of production have been managed without the use of money. So be careful lest you think it always runs in one direction. Both of them can happen without the other. You can have workers producing more value than they get without money being the measure of how that's done, and there's plenty of examples historically of that. Number two, on international, let's be careful here. It's not our job, for example, sitting here in the United States, to worry all that much about how and when people in other parts of the world are going to make their decisions about whether and how to pursue whatever it is we're doing here. It's enough that we do it here, that we are successful. That's a major piece of work that's going to take years. And given, for example, the importance of the United States in the world economy, for no other reason, what we do here will be something that will attract the attention and the study of people all over the world, who will then decide what portions of what it is we are doing that fit their cultures, their desires, their movements, needs, and we'll move in that direction. The uneven way in which we move towards this system will not be different from the extremely uneven way that transitions before capitalism happened, and we're not going to solve that problem by some organized global movement. We shouldn't set ourselves that task. There'd be a lot of arrogance in doing so, even if we tried.
I've got a different take on the international questions that I've written about a bit. I do advocate what I call socialist protectionism. And that has to do with the fact that competition, you know, there's good kinds of competition, healthy competition, and there's destructive competition. And international trade, you know, a certain amount of competition, some other country's developing a good way of producing something and they compete, that puts pressure on our producers, fine. What you don't want is wage competition. You don't want workers of the world competing to see who will work for less. You don't want environmental regulation competition. The countries that don't have regulations, you know, can produce cheaper and so forth. You know, so you want to block those. How do you block those? You block those with a tariff. It says goods coming in from those countries, we tack on a tariff to make it equivalent to what it would be if it were produced by workers, you know, making our standard of living or something, our wages and, you know, environmental regulations. But that's the protectionist part. The socialist part, I say, that money should go back to the poor countries. I mean, among countries of equal level of development, fine, you can have this trade, but it should go back to the poor countries, to the governments, if they're progressive governments, to the unions, to the labor NGOs, to whatever, you know, because we do, in a sense, it's fair trade. You know, we're going to make sure that there's fair trade, not free trade, you know, but the excess goes back, you know, to the workers. And it's also important to think about, you know, what do poor countries actually need? Okay, so it's not just a matter of money, okay? And there's certain things, I think, that a democratic economy can make available. So, for example, intellectual property ought to be free, okay? If we invent something, we don't have to worry about them competing with us. Make that available to people in poor countries. You know, educational resources to the extent that we have them. But remember, two things. You know, first of all, the things that poor countries mainly need, you know, basic health care, basic education, those are labor-intensive things. You know, we know from the example of Cuba, for example, you can be a poor country and you can provide, you know, those kinds of things, okay? So you've got that, you know, and as I say, maybe opening up, you know, educational, you know, technology transfer. You can have whatever technology, you know, we've invented. But also recognizing that there is no, that, you know, in a certain sense, certain parts of the world are underdeveloped, other parts are overdeveloped. I mean, our part, we're going to have to worry about scaling back the level of consumption. More countries have to increase consumption. But we should, they should have, you know, no one should have any illusions. There's no way that poor countries can consume at the level of rich countries. That is totally ecologically unsustainable. The bad news. The good news is you don't have to consume like that to have healthy, happy, you know, productive lives. So each country is going to have, you know, their own way of developing. Okay, we will help to the degree that we can, but, you know, again, yeah, what we learn, the examples that we can set, you know, people, other countries hopefully can learn from that, you know, and vice versa. Things are going on in other countries. We can learn from their mistakes, their successes. I mean, that's the way I see the international.
We'll stop. I just want to say briefly two things on the international side. You all understand that a socialist planned economy, or the kind of economy I'm really talking here, has trade barriers. You can't manage the system without what was called protectionism. So that's part of the planning system in any of these models, everybody's model. The second question is, how do you deal with the rest of the world? And the second one, I'm giving you some experience from way back when, long ago, when I was a State Department official, 100 years ago. We would try to do wonderful good things in the liberal tradition to help the third world. And we'd pass some money, we'd get some money out there, and, you know, every time you did it, the corporations would be in there and distort it and use it in a different way. Bottom line, we will not be able to be creative contributors to other countries until we get our own act together. So I think here first, so we know what the hell we're doing, we may be able to make a contribution. So that's where my posture, we got a lot of work to do figuring out what we're going to do. And if we get the values right out of that, we may actually be able to make a different contribution.
Okay, with that, I'm sorry, we have to wrap it up.
Thanks for listening to the Gar Alperovitz podcast. To find articles, interviews, audio, video, and more, go to www.americabeyondcapitalism.com.